Ascent Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Monetary and Fiscal History of the United States, 1961 through 2021, by Alan S. Blinder. Narrated by Todd McLaren. Publisher's note: in this audio edition, you will hear references to figures and tables present in the print and ebook formats of the book. Introduction. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. George Santayana. These famous words have been repeated so many times since George Santayana wrote them in 1905 that they have become a cliché. But remember, clichés often capture important grains of truth. Mark Twain was probably more accurate when he, allegedly, asserted that history doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. Sad to say, many economists and policymakers are not very skilled at picking up rhyming schemes. This book is intended to help. During 50-plus years as an academic economist, one thing I have learned is that my fellow economists have a remarkable propensity for forgetting or ignoring the past. Such lapses of memory may not be terribly problematic in the world of pure theory. After all, scientific progress is rarely made by looking backward. The most reliable route to academic success is jumping onto the latest bandwagon. Economic theory runs in fads, and many fads don't last long. But forgetfulness in the world of policy can lead to errors, maybe even to grievous errors with serious consequences, which, I suppose, is what Santayana had in mind when he chose the verb condemned. Policymakers and their economic advisors must resist fads, but they must also avoid getting trapped in the past. Walking that fine line is one of the key ways in which the science of economics merges into the art of economics. Sometimes the merger works well, but often it doesn't. And that's part of the story I tell in this book. This book is light on economic theory, and equations are rarer than dodo birds. However, a number of the theoretical and empirical controversies that have surrounded and sometimes enveloped monetary and fiscal policy find natural homes here. Furthermore, part of the evolution of thought on macroeconomic policy involves, or was even spurred by, developments in theory. So several aspects of macroeconomic theory necessarily play roles in the historical narrative. That said, this book is a work of history, not of theory, so I studiously avoid sojourns into theory for its own sake. Rather, I limit myself to theoretical developments that had serious bearings on policymaking. So, for example, you will find much in this book about monetarism, rational expectations, and even supply-side economics, but little about such popular, among academic economists, topics as Ricardian equivalence, time inconsistency, and the fiscal theory of the price level. As far as I can tell, those and other topics had little or no bearing on actual policymaking. The worlds of ideas and policy have always interacted strongly, and the 60-year period covered in this volume is no exception. Developments in the world of ideas, usually coming from academia, sometimes have major impacts on the world of policy. Developments in the world of events, including policy events, sometimes have major impacts on thinking in the academy. This two-way interaction is a natural and necessary sub-theme of this book, and so is its opposite, cases in which policymakers resisted sensible ideas and academics ignored reality. A second, more important sub-theme is the interaction between policy and politics. In the realm of monetary policy, where the Federal Reserve normally sets short-term interest rates and its other policy instruments independently, politics has mostly been a sidebar issue, though with some notable exceptions, for example, Richard Nixon and Arthur Burns. Technocrats, mostly economists, make the policy decisions. But in the realm of fiscal policy, where publicly debated budget issues are at the forefront, Politics rules the roost. Fiscal policy decisions are made by elected politicians, though hopefully informed by facts and by sound economic thinking. These politicians are guided by forms of logic that are alien to economists. I've called them political logic, to distinguish them from Aristotelian logic. Nonetheless, no history of fiscal policy can avoid delving, sometimes deeply, into the politics of the day. Writing a history of fiscal policy in America that ignored the politics would be leaving out of the play not just the Prince of Denmark, but also Ophelia, Laertes, and Polonius. So you will find substantial political discussion of fiscal policy in this book, though I emphasize the economics far more than the politics. In that regard, I should level with the listener by stating right up front that I have long been a center-left Democrat. However, in writing this book, unlike in writing my op-ed columns, I have tried hard to relegate my personal political views to second or third fiddle. Where there were controversies in policymaking, I don't shy away from the issues. Instead, I try to give the listener a sense of the arguments on both sides, though without hiding my own views. This book is designed to serve two audiences. One is my fellow economists, or at least those of them who wish to learn some of the lessons of history, lessons that their graduate educations probably did not teach them, and that they, in turn, probably don't teach to their students. Such listeners may browse selected portions of the book, and then place the volume on their bookshelves for future reference. The other audience is the general listener who is interested in economic policy, or at least in macroeconomic policy. How does the past shape today's attitudes, opinions, and debates over monetary and fiscal policy? What worked and what didn't? And why? For those listeners especially, the book is arranged chronologically, not thematically, starting in 1961 and continuing to the end of 2021. It is meant to be heard as one continuous story, a non-fiction story, to be sure. The title is not accidental, but rather an intentional homage to Milton Friedman's and Anna Schwartz's monumental and monetary history of the United States, 1867 through 1960, from which the doctrine of monetarism and our current view of the Great Depression, among other things, derives. Two changes from their title are obvious. First, I picked up the story exactly where they left off, in 1961. Although I am far from a monetarist, I have no desire to engage in debate with the ghosts of Friedman and Schwartz. This work is in no sense a sequel to theirs. Second, and much more important, inserting the words "and fiscal" into the title reflects a major change in focus. This volume tells the 60-year story of monetary and fiscal policy as those two types of stabilization policy struggled, sometimes cooperatively, sometimes combatively, to fight recessions, unemployment, and inflation in the United States. One can argue that there was no such thing as fiscal policy in the United States prior to 1961 anyway, but I'm not going to engage in that argument. There certainly has been lots of fiscal policy since then, and it has mattered. Old age offers precious few advantages, except in writing history. I began studying economics as a Princeton University freshman in the fall of 1963, which means I have lived through virtually all the events recounted here. Not just lived through them, but also observed them, and sometimes even participated in them. I have also been writing about economic policy ever since I penned my first op-ed over 40 years ago. I have served as an informal advisor to many U.S. policymakers, including several presidential candidates, for decades, and intensely so as a member of President Bill Clinton's original Council of Economic Advisors in 1993 and 1994. Following that stint of about a year and a half, I briefly became an actual policymaker as vice chair of the Federal Reserve Board in 1994 through 1996. And I have kept in pretty close touch with many Federal Reserve policymakers and with economists in Democratic and even some Republican administrations ever since. So some portions of the history recounted in this book are based on first-hand experience, and a great deal is based on close second-hand knowledge. Finally, while it's an overused and sometimes abused adjective, my macroeconomic framework is decidedly Keynesian. How could it be otherwise if you want to make sense of history? Rival doctrines to Keynesianism have come and gone over the decades covered in this volume. Monetarism, new classical economics, supply-side economics, and others. But only one survived. The competitors to Keynesian economics all either fell of their own weight, for example, monetarism, or saw their most useful aspects incorporated into the Keynesian tradition, for example, rational expectations. Keynesian economics, circa 2021, differs in many ways from the theory originated by John Maynard Keynes in 1936, but the family resemblance remains. As Mark Twain might have said, it rhymes. Acknowledgements. This book represents a life's journey through macroeconomics, and as such, my first debts of gratitude go to the dozens of teachers, scores of colleagues, thousands of students, and even some journalists who have helped sharpen my thinking on these matters. Teaching helps you learn. As this manuscript was taking shape, I benefited enormously from helpful comments and suggestions on earlier drafts from my friends Ben Bernanke, Michael Bordo, William Dudley, Barry Eichengreen, Philip Friedman, and Robert Solo, plus three fine anonymous reviewers arranged by Princeton University Press. I know that some of these listeners disagree in part with what I have written, which is probably inevitable and certainly healthy. They should not be implicated in my opinions. I also owe a large debt of gratitude to Stephanie Hu for skillful and thorough research assistance, including an uncanny ability to find the unfindable, and to Will McClure and Shirley Wren for helping a man who needed help to produce the many graphs in this volume, often under time pressure. Overseeing all this, my wonderful long-time assistant, Kathleen Hurley, watched every detail carefully, saved me from numerous errors, produced the references and captions for the figures, and generally kept the proverbial trains running on time, as she always does. Writing this book took longer than it should have because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Through it all, I benefited from release time from Princeton University, financial support from Princeton School of Public and International Affairs, and research support from the Griswold Center for Economic Policy Studies. I thank them all. Once the manuscript was near completion, it went into the capable hands of the folks at Princeton University Press, led by Joe Jackson, senior editor, and Josh Drake, editorial associate, and including Carl Spurtzum, cover design, Carmina Alvarez, design, and James Schneider, publicity. PUP staff were accommodating and efficient at every stage, making my job easier, not harder. The people at Westchester Publishing Services, who processed the manuscript, impressed me with their skill, speed, and responsiveness. I thank especially Christine Mara, Yvette Ramsey, Jody Ann Sclafani, and Teresa Carcaldi. I am a fussy author who is often at war with his copy editors. Not so with Christine and Yvette, who were a pleasure to work with. But most deeply of all, I thank my wife and life companion, Madeline Blinder. We have been married for almost as long as the 6 decades covered in this book. Not only has Madeline been a loving partner, she was instrumental in several crucial decisions that account for the first-hand nature of parts of this book. Much of my personal involvement in the monetary and fiscal history of the United States, 1961 through 2021, is due to her. Thank you is far too weak a phrase. 1. Fiscal Policy on the New Frontier. Now let us turn to the problem of our fiscal policy. Here the myths are legion, and the truth hard to find. John F. Kennedy, Commencement Address, Yale University, June 11, 1962. The beginning of the New Economics, a term coined by the media for the already old idea of using fiscal policy to influence economic activity, can be dated precisely to June 7, 1962. At a press conference that day, President John F. Kennedy promised to ask Congress for an across-the-board reduction in personal and corporate tax rates, which will not be offset by other reforms. In other words, a net tax reduction. His tax proposal took a long time to be put into concrete form within the administration, and then to wend its way through a recalcitrant Congress. It eventually became law in February 1964, after his death, and at least in part as a tribute to the assassinated president. The Kennedy-Johnson tax cut, as it has been called ever since, was quickly hailed as a great success. Fiscal stimulus had been deployed before, of course, by the Swedes in the 1930s and by Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, although the magnitudes then were puny relative to the immense need, and on a massive scale during World War II, though the last of these was certainly not motivated by any Keynesian reasoning. So the new economics was not as new as the media made it out to be. Still, it was a sharp departure from the fiscal legacy of Dwight Eisenhower's administration. Background: Eisenhower and the Three Recessions. As Herbert Stein argued in his definitive history of how the fiscal revolution came to America, Eisenhower and his team understood basic Keynesian ideas, but were reluctant to employ them because the president did not want to stray far from a balanced budget. Eisenhower was also almost obsessed by fears of inflation, which he associated with budget deficits, even though the inflation rate, as measured by the Consumer Price Index, or CPI, averaged a mere 1.4% during his presidency. Although the average real growth rate over Eisenhower's 8 years was a respectable 2.9%, one reason why inflation remained so low was that his two terms were marred by three recessions. The first of these, in 1953-54, was basically caused by a sharp fiscal contraction. In part, this recession was a normal adjustment from wartime to peacetime. Federal defense spending fell sharply as the Korean War ended, but it was not necessary to couple that drop in defense spending with declines in non-defense spending, too, unless you were firmly tied to the mast of the balanced budget ideology. Eisenhower was. Unlike 1953 and 54, the recessions of 1957 and 58 and 1960 and 61 cannot be laid directly at the doorstep of the Eisenhower administration. The former was part of a worldwide slowdown, though a tightening of monetary policy played some role, too. Inflation was still the main worry then. Fighting inflation with monetary policy probably played a larger role in causing the 1960-1961 recession. More to the point of this chapter, the administration and Congress did little to mitigate either slump. The fiscal inaction as the 1960-1961 recession developed was particularly noteworthy because it greatly chagrined the Vice President, Richard M. Nixon, who fought a losing battle for fiscal stimulus within the administration and then lost the 1960 election to Kennedy by a razor-thin margin. Nixon believed that the recession cost him the 1960 election, and he may well have been right. As we will hear in Chapter 4, it was a lesson he would not forget. The New Frontier and Tax Cuts. Attitudes began to change quickly when Kennedy replaced Eisenhower as president in January 1961. But you couldn't have anticipated that from Kennedy's 1960 campaign. The young senator from Massachusetts campaigned on a pledge to get America moving again, as if the country had stood still under Eisenhower. Yet Kennedy also ran as a fiscal conservative, seeing no contradiction there. That fiscal conservatism perhaps reflected the views of his wealthy and domineering father, who had been a titan of Wall Street and held views that were characteristic of that circle at that time. If anything, Nixon sounded a bit more Keynesian than Kennedy during the 1960 campaign. But Kennedy, who was born in 1917, had grown up in the Keynesian era, was intellectually curious, and wanted to hear from the experts he had brought to Washington. That group of advisors, led by Walter Heller of the University of Minnesota, chair of Kennedy's original Council of Economic Advisers, CEA, was composed mostly of enthusiastic Keynesians, which was probably no coincidence. One member of that stellar group was the estimable James Tobin of Yale, a subsequent Nobel Prize winner whom Kennedy hired as a CEA member. Tobin famously demurred when the president-elect called to ask him to join the new administration. "I'm afraid you've got the wrong guy, Mr. President," Tobin replied. "I'm an ivory tower economist." Kennedy responded, "That's the best kind. I'm an ivory tower president." It is easy to imagine Kennedy smiling his famous smile as he said this over the phone. Tobin later recalled that, true to that vignette, innocent of economics on Inauguration Day, he was an interested and apt pupil of the professors in the executive office building. So what was new about the new economics? Certainly not the basic theoretical framework. The underlying ideas dated from Keynes's general theory, which had been published in 1936. By 1961, its message was standard fare, at least in left-of-center circles, and probably beyond, even though many conservatives of the day condemned Keynesian ideas as socialist. They weren't strong on definitions. Heller later noted that the rationale of the 1964 tax cut proposal came straight out of the country's post-war economics textbooks. Indeed, the premier such textbook of the day was written by MIT's Paul Samuelson, who was the acknowledged intellectual leader of Kennedy's team of economists, even though he never took a position in Washington. Perhaps the most important and obvious feature of the new economics was that the Kennedy-Johnson tax cut was the first deliberate and avowedly Keynesian fiscal policy action ever undertaken by the U.S. government. While the ideas were not new, acting on them was. It is in this sense that the Kennedy-Johnson tax cut is rightly seen as a watershed event. It was also considered revolutionary at the time to cut taxes when the federal budget was already in deficit and the economy was recovering, rather than mired in recession. Indeed, Robert Solow, who was on the CEA staff then, recalled to me, in personal correspondence, that the Kennedy economic team went through mental gymnastics to argue that the deficit would not exceed Eisenhower's largest deficit. That was deemed important. Prior to the Kennedy tax proposals, counter-cyclical fiscal policies were considered emergency measures to be reserved for deep recessions, such as the situation faced by Roosevelt. Looking back a few years later, Heller wrote, with perhaps a tinge of hyperbole, that John F. Kennedy and Lyndon B. Johnson stand out, then, as the first modern economists in the American presidency. Their administrations were largely free of the old mythology and wrong-headed economics which had viewed government deficits as synonymous with inflation, government spending increases as a likely source of depressions that would curl your hair, and government debts as an immoral burden on our grandchildren. Were Heller alive today, he probably would be shocked to see that all three of these pre-Keynesian ideas live on, if only at the lip service level. While Heller doubtless exaggerated, there does seem to have been a sharp intellectual break between the Eisenhower and Kennedy administrations. In a 1972 lecture at Princeton, Tobin looked back on what he saw as new in the new economics, listing three main items. 1. The notion that government could and should keep the economy close to a path of steady real growth at a constant target rate of unemployment, which the New Frontiersman set at 4%. 2. Getting rid of the taboo on deficit spending. And 3. Seeking to liberate monetary policy and to focus it squarely on the same macroeconomic objectives that should guide fiscal policy. The first item represents clear advocacy of what would first be praised and later derided as fine-tuning. An even clearer clarion call for fine-tuning came from Heller in his 1966 book, in which he asserted that fiscal policy appropriately became more activist and bolder in the early 1960s. In fact, he claimed, "We now take for granted that the government must step in to provide the essential stability at high levels of employment and growth that the market mechanism, left alone, cannot deliver." This necessary activism, he added, means that not only monetary policy, but fiscal policy has to be put on constant rather than intermittent alert. Precious few economists would go that far today. The third item on Tobin's list is notable in light of the monetarist-Keynesian debate that would follow, one in which Tobin would play a leading role. But it is even more notable, indeed jarring from a modern perspective, for its lack of fealty to the now sacred doctrine of central bank independence. It may seem amazing from a modern perspective, but belief in central bank independence was not holy writ then, not even among economists. Indeed, the January 1964 Economic Report of the President had warned the Federal Reserve, in print, that it would be self-defeating to cancel the stimulus of tax reduction by tightening money. Gardner Ackley of the University of Michigan, who replaced Heller as CEA chair in November 1964, was even more blunt. "I would do everything I could to reduce or even eliminate the independence of the Federal Reserve." Modern-day Ackleys would never say such a thing. The belief in central bank independence now runs deep. Alan Meltzer, the renowned monetarist and historian of the Federal Reserve, had criticized Fed Chair William McChesney Martin for being too pliant at the time. "Policy coordination ensnared Martin in administration policy," Meltzer claimed. "He willingly sacrificed part of the Federal Reserve's independence for the opportunity to be part of the economic team, make his views known to the president, and coordinate policy actions." This judgment seems harsh in view of Martin's subsequent clash with Johnson. Besides, is policy coordination really such a bad thing? Especially if it does not imply Federal Reserve subservience to the White House. If the Fed saw that a big tax cut was coming, might it not want to adjust monetary policy accordingly? Yale's Arthur Oaken, who succeeded Ackley as chair of the CEA, rendered a much kinder judgment. "The Federal Reserve Board put on an outstanding performance in 1966, making wise judgments and, most of all, having the courage to act promptly and decisively on them." My own view, and I think it is the historical consensus, is far closer to Oaken's. And don't forget that the dominant attitude in the early to mid-1960s was that the Fed would and should accommodate expansive fiscal policy, an early version of what modern economics now calls fiscal dominance. When it came to stabilization policy, monetary policy occupied the backseat, not the driver's seat at the time. Indeed, Kennedy confessed that he helped himself remember the difference between fiscal and monetary policy by the fact that monetary and Martin both began with the letter M. But it was the second item on Tobin's list that was the real political stickler. The balanced budget ideology was not only alive and well at the time, it was dominant. And it made Kennedy hesitant to propose anything as radical as a tax cut, with the budget already in deficit. Heller, Samuelson, and Tobin worked hard to persuade the new president intellectually. But support from Congress was underwhelming, and his own Treasury Secretary, C. Douglas Dillon, a Wall Street Republican, opposed the idea. Dillon favored tax reform, not a tax cut. Hard as it is for a modern listener to imagine, selling a tax cut to Congress in those days was hard work. Political gravity pulled strongly toward a balanced budget. President Kennedy nonetheless decided to make a large tax cut the centerpiece of his new economics. His stated intention when he announced the tax cut on June 7, 1962, was to get it through Congress quickly. But that was not to be, not even close. The idea of enacting a fiscal stimulus in a non-recessionary environment.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?